This is Bill Nelson, director of the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center, and we're here today with Dave McConkie. And David is one of the leading figures in bladder cancer research and has been so for quite some amount of time. What's been very exciting in the last few years is the research in bladder cancer is leading to clear clinical innovations that are going to affect clinical practice for years to come, improving the outcomes for many with bladder cancer. We've been so excited about it here at Johns Hopkins that we've helped launch the Greenberg Bladder Cancer Institute, and David McConkie is the leader of this institute. He's also a major figure in the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network group, so-called BCAN, B-C-A-N, and is wired into bladder cancer like nobody else. So we're going to go straight to you, David. What's going on in bladder cancer? Why is everyone so excited all of a sudden?
Well, we've been in the background for years. Bladder cancer is a lot more common than people think it is. It's the fourth most common cancer in men and a leading cause of death and a significant cause of cancer in women. And most people don't know that. Most people don't know that cigarette smoking is a leading risk factor for developing bladder cancer. So you mentioned the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network. A big part of our mission across the community has been to get the word out and make people aware of just how common this disease is. So that, I think, is starting to occur, again, with a lot of really effective work being done by Beacon and their partners. In addition to that, we've had some investment from the National Cancer Institute and other funding bodies that has caused a transformative change in the way we understand bladder cancer through deep sequencing projects that have been very collaborative and done globally. We now appreciate that bladder cancers are similar to other cancers that we know quite a bit about, including breast cancer and head and neck cancers and others. And by leveraging this information, we've actually been able to see paths toward effective treatments and cures. And a lot of that work is being evaluated right now in clinical trials, most of them run by the federal government, that have completed the accrual of patients and they're about ready to be analyzed by these methods. So we anticipate that this work will really, as you said, lead to practice changing paradigms in the near future.
So that is one thing that has been very exciting to watch, is the momentum gathering to take on bladder cancer. As you know, David, I, of course, was a genitourinary medical oncologist. And when I started 30 years ago, the primary disease that we thought the most about was bladder cancer. And very quickly, over that ensuing number of years, prostate cancer sucked all the air out of the research in genitourinary cancer. Lots of people focusing on prostate cancer, and many others were one of them. And I think bladder cancer did take a sort of seat at the back of the auditorium for all that great research effort. But there are aspects of bladder cancer that remain very interesting. So more than 80,000 cases in the U.S., but only about 17,000 deaths. Bad invasive metastatic bladder cancer is a bad disease, and as you mentioned, by subdividing it and pick the one to go after with which treatment, we're making progress in that group. But the other side of it is this awareness may have benefits on its own, right? Many bladder cancers that we detect are not as life-threatening and can be readily treated if gotten to pretty early. Describe how that works. How do people come to attention? Is it because of blood in their urine or funny symptoms, or how does this work?
You're absolutely right. Most of the time, it's blood in the urine that brings people in. And unfortunately, blood in the urine in men means something a little different than blood in the urine in women. And so as a consequence of that, oftentimes women are given antibiotic courses over and over again, even though they have bladder cancer present in their bladders.
So the thought is they have a urinary tract infection or something that can easily be dealt with in an office primary care practice.
Exactly. Yes, and so blood in the urine for a woman doesn't raise quite as much concern as it does for a man. So actually one of the things that we're focusing our attention on in the Bladder Cancer Institute is to develop a specialized center for women down at Sibley Hospital in Washington, D.C., where our experts are really going to understand current practice patterns to speed up diagnosis for women who have blood in their urine, where they actually do have bladder cancer, and also to look at unique treatment approaches that might be more beneficial in women than are currently being used today. Also to understand the biology of the cancers, because we know that men get bladder cancer about three times as often as women do. But women tend to get a more aggressive form of cancer. So we'd like to understand, again, the biological basis for that discrepancy. But blood in the urine, sometimes symptoms, sometimes they can be mistaken for other things like infections. And so as a consequence, getting somebody in to a urologist is really important. And oftentimes that doesn't happen as quickly for women.
And at that point, they use an instrument that goes through the urethra, the urine tube, and enables them to look at the bladder.
That's right.
And if they see something, they can biopsy it and typically remove it entirely.
Exactly.
And if that's all that's there, then the treatment is then oriented towards preventing another one from coming or keeping it from coming back. And at that point, these people, survival-wise, do pretty well. It's more of a nuisance condition for that group, isn't it?
That's right. And for those people, it's also important to understand that this is not exactly a pleasant procedure to have this camera stuck into your bladder. And so one important goal for ongoing research here and elsewhere is to develop methods that might be able to take urine and tell us, just using a urine specimen, whether there might be cancer in the bladder or not.
So this might help for the people who show up with hematuria, but this also might help if you know they have a bladder cancer and then you can't see any evidence of it in the urine. If it pops back, maybe that would be the trigger for another cystoscopy, it's called, that instrument.
Exactly.
Into the
bladder. For example, George Netto and Bert Vogelstein here have shown that you can actually detect cancer-associated mutations in the urine, even when disease isn't evident clinically. And so we're excited about the possibility of developing tests that will be less expensive, because the camera work that's done is expensive. It requires a urologist to do it, and it happens frequently in a patient's life because these cancers are not lethal, so they have to keep coming back over and over again for this. Less expensive, but also less intrusive, so you don't have to have this camera stuck up in your bladder. So we're hopeful that will happen soon.
So in the logic or jargon of the bladder cancer treatment world, if the cancer has invaded into the muscle around the bladder is a muscular organ that squeezes the urine out. If it's invaded through into that muscular region, this is a more ominous behavior of the cancer, usually subjected to more drastic kind of treatment. Historically, that treatment was pretty much limited to removal of the bladder and then directing the urine out to the side in a bag, or to invent a receptacle or something like that. These things were significant drags on quality of life and I think may have slowed some people down to seek help. But nowadays, as the treatments are improving, you see more and more people able to keep their bladder in a very useful way. How is that working out?
It's working out actually quite well, and excitingly, I think that here in North America, there's finally an appreciation for the fact that you don't have to remove the bladder to have just as good chance at cure using radiation therapy and chemotherapy and aggressive local surgery. And clearly keeping the patient's bladder intact is a top priority. In addition to that, as again a consequence of what we're learning about the biology of bladder cancer, we can make predictions about who is going to be rendered free of cancer with chemotherapy alone. And so we have clinical trials opening up this year, several around the country, that are testing the idea that we can use this information to essentially let people keep their bladders as well. So it's a very exciting time for them.
And so these people would then get their chemotherapy. It's easy to find the cancer by that cystoscope kind of strategy, inserting into the bladder, looking at it. They get treated with their chemotherapy, and if it completely disappears, this is generally a good finding, is what you're saying.
Yes.
And for many of these people, they may need very little other therapy, perhaps some radiation or something,
but they
don't need to have the bladder removed specifically.
Exactly. And the other thing we've appreciated, that it's still effective and safe to remove the bladder later if it's necessary. And so with that combination, it's created an opportunity to let a lot more patients keep their bladders.
So this was the world ongoing that you have been a major contributor to, which is to figure out by molecularly, if you will, using the tools that we have today, subtyping these bladder cancers to say this one might respond particularly well to the chemotherapy that we've been using for a number of years. This one might not. We need to think of something else, and directing treatment in that way. But onto this background in the last few years has really arrived quite like a blustery wind or something, has arrived these new immune checkpoint inhibitors. And they have had fascinating benefits for many people with many different types of cancer, and bladder cancer is one of them.
That's absolutely right, Bill. So that's the other disruptive influence we've had in our field, which is that immunotherapy works really well in patients who would have died of their disease not long ago. And so as a consequence of that, we've been able to engage industry for the first time ever in doing big clinical trials, big expensive clinical trials with us, but also doing the molecular, the expensive molecular stuff that goes along with that. In addition to that, with the tools available at our disposal, we can also make predictions about who's benefiting and who's not. These are expensive drugs, as you know, over $100,000 a year per patient on average. And so it would be important not only to find those patients who are benefiting, but those patients who are not, to find something else for them as soon as possible that will work better for them.
Is there any sense, I know this is the great question for melanoma, for lung cancer, and for all the other places these immune checkpoint inhibitors are being used, but there's two sort of general themes that people will come up with. One, if the cancer has a lot of mutations, and so the proteins that are produced from the genome that are defective, there's a lot of them. The cancer cell looks very different than any normal cell in the body. That sort of increases the chance that the immune system will see it and increase the number of immune cells, and they'll show up ready to kill the cancer but be held at bay. That one seems to be the kind that responds great to these things. And then these other cancers, not as many mutations, hardly any immune cells at the site of the cancer. And I don't think anyone has a great bead on how to go after those yet. Is this going to play out in bladder cancer faster to figure out what's going on there?
I think because of the tools we have now at our disposal and also the engagement from industry, I do believe that's going to be the case. So already we've seen a study led by Genentech develop some very good predictions about which tumors are resistant and what properties of those tumors might be making them resistant. Parallel efforts from private groups have been doing the same thing. And we actually have an idea of combining the immune checkpoint inhibitors with another class of drugs called the fibroblast growth factor receptor inhibitors, which, by the way, are also clinically active in advanced bladder cancer. And there are indications that this combination will work in some of those tumors that we call cold because they don't have many T lymphocytes or immune cells in them.
Well, that's interesting. So there may be, if you will, a respond to a particular growth factor inhibitor, and that's probably that growth factor pathway is certainly driving that cancer, versus one that appears to be held in check more or less by the immune system, and they may not be the same one. I was just yesterday reviewing some data from the people working on colorectal cancer, coming to a very similar conclusion. The major growth stimulating pathways that are corrupted there, typically APC and these kinds of genes, not being the ones with so much of an immune infiltration.
Right.
Other pathways, a lot of immune infiltration, that seems to dictate who responds. So similar themes playing out here. Huh?
We definitely see that the tumors that have these driving mutations in FGF receptor 3 are cold.
And cold so meaning they're not the, hot and inflamed
exactly,
with T cells.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so just the correlation of those two things is intriguing. The fact that we do have really good drugs now to hit both of them at the same time means that a lot of companies are doing that. We're working with a company called AstraZeneca who's interested in this.
Any sense yet in any of the clinical research that successfully inhibiting that pathway in these folks makes the tumors any hotter?
That's the number one priority we have right now. We have an ongoing clinical trial, so-called neoadjuvant, means it's pre-surgical, where we're giving one of these drugs with the intent purpose of checking that. So we've done seven pairs of patients. You'll have to stay tuned for the rest of them before I tell you the answer.
So another bladder cancer-oriented set of questions for our listeners. With the superficial bladder cancer, that's not invaded into the muscle, the one we don't remove the bladder for or never really did often, and use chemotherapy and the like, one of the great tools historically for the treatment is to basically redirect the use of what was the tuberculosis vaccine for all intents and purposes by, rather than giving it as a vaccine in the arm, by stuffing it in the bladder. And it works to some degree. I think that's irrefutable at this point. What's going on there? How does that work?
Oh, that's the number one question for those of us who are interested in that. We still don't know, Bill. But right now, everybody is very excited about the possibility that it might be through the same immune mechanism.
Immune mechanism, yeah.
And so there are, Noah Hahn here at Johns Hopkins has got a trial called Adapt Bladder, where he'll be looking at combining immune checkpoint inhibitors with this drug that you're referring to.
Which we call BCG, just
exactly.
So that people will know. Yeah.
So that's one of the things that's being tested in that trial. I will say, though, you know, as a scientist, I don't know that there's much direct evidence that that's how this drug works. Mm-hmm. And so in addition to that, we have a funded collaboration with Northwestern University and the University of Texas San Antonio to look at that specific question. In this case, the science is way behind the clinical trials.
That's right.
It's kind of
almost empirically developed.
Exactly.
I think there was some sense that they thought this was an avenue towards immunotherapy, but
sure.
They couldn't say which part of the immune system was engaged the most productively or the like. Yeah.
We'd like to understand what's happening so that we can, again, develop these kinds of predictions about who's benefiting and who's not, and what might be combined with this drug BCG to help other people benefit from it as well.
So one thing I think that you have been very successful in managing is something that a great number of people across the country have been concerned about for many years, and that's just the idea that there's great research, innovation moving towards the clinic in Baltimore here at the Kimmel Cancer Center. There's great stuff in New York at Memorial Sloan Kettering, at Sinai or NYU, great stuff in Oklahoma at Oklahoma State, and that no one talks to each other and they don't work together very well. What I've seen in watching what you've been able to do is that the bladder cancer community across the world, people at different sites, have been coming together to ask the more impactful questions, to share information and data and reagents and new treatments as quickly as possible. Is this something that the Greenberg Bladder Cancer Institute and the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network working together, is this what they're trying to promote? Because it seems to be working.
That is exactly right. It's written into our charter, the Greenberg Bladder Cancer Institute. So this was one of the reasons I decided I wanted to be the director of this institute, because I totally agree with this approach. And the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network has been reinforcing this culture, again, partly by necessity, because we needed to find ways of competing for the resources that were available. But also partly, I think, because it felt like the fastest way to generate progress. Our institute now is getting to the point where we're reaching beyond North America. So I just came back from a trip to Paris, where we've initiated a collaboration with three major institutions there, one of which is a real leader in bladder cancer genetic research. And we've done the same thing in the UK, and we have other plans to do it in other locations around the world. The world is a lot smaller, as you know, mm-hmm. and there are intelligent people all over the place. Another way we're doing that is we're holding meetings here on campus, where we invite all of these people from all over the world to come and have scientific discussions with us. So collaboration is becoming a high priority for all people working in cancer and other medical health issues. I'd say we're lucky that it's been part of our culture for quite a while now.
So another feature of the Greenberg Bladder Cancer Institute was not just to connect the people who really think night and day about bladder cancer together, that's clearly working now on an international scale, but to try and cross disciplines to engage people who would not have ever thought about bladder cancer, perhaps from engineering specialties, population sciences, computer algorithm generators, all these kinds of people, artificial intelligence researchers. How is that coming to your taste, and which of these adjunctive technologies or adjunctive perspectives do you expect to have the biggest impact in the near future?
Well, it's hard to pick one as my favorite. I think all of them are really going to be impactful. As a lot of people know, we talk a lot about big data, and the folks who are good at computers have fantastic ways of handling big data and sharing big data that we all need to take advantage of. There are opportunities using special imaging and computers and artificial intelligence to do better at diagnosis than the human eye can do. And so we've engaged partners here at Johns Hopkins who are involved in applied physics and and other disciplines to help us with that. You mentioned the cystoscopy, putting the camera up inside the bladder. One example of a clear opportunity is to help us do that better using something called machine learning to help us recognize patterns that we're seeing there so that you don't necessarily need an expert urologist to be able to sensitively to detect cancer. And there are many, many other examples of this, but this being at Johns Hopkins gives us a kid in the candy store attitude because there are so many areas of excellence across the institution.
So this has been tremendous, and we've been here today with David McConkie talking about bladder cancer, which is just really supercharged at this point for some major breakthroughs related to overall outcomes in the disease, the better use of chemotherapy, increasing and more intelligent use of these new immunotherapy tools, enabling people to not have their life threatened by the disease, but also to keep their bladder and their high quality of life as they get into their 60s and 70s, which is the sort of target group that often get bladder cancer. So really wonderful things at play. And so thank you, David, for joining us. Please remember that we have a Twitter account. You can follow us at Hopkins Kimmel. We have a Facebook page. You can look on the web for the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center. You can also search iTunes and find a collection of these podcasts. Again, search for the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center. And Dave McConkie also has a Twitter, which is at DJ McConkie, McConkey. And he posts regularly on the latest in bladder cancer if you're interested in it. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Can't wait to talk to you again.